It ain't easy adding wind power to a diesel power plant. Sometimes it means a plant has to be overhauled. And that's just the beginning. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. But Alaska Power Utilities are making progress integrating wind energy. Our phone number, 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK, and Anchorage local call at 550-8422. Email talk at APRN.org. Getting real about wind power is the subject today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com. Help manage subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing in Alaska. Apply for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide critical advice to the Federal Subsistence Board on the management of subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing on federal public lands. The deadline to apply is February 18th. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence at fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, howdy, friends. Here we are again, all together, all across the state of Alaska, live and direct, and we're talking about wind power, and this directly happens because the legislature is convening, because the price of fuel is outrageous, and because there's actually some progress being made in getting wind power out to rural Alaska. With me is Jenny Fay. She's the co-author of a report that's already out of date that came out last year. She's an economist at the University of Alaska Anchorage Institute of Social and Economic Research. Jenny, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, in this ICER study, it shows that we're already getting pretty significant progress, but apparently there's a whole lot more that's been installed since you guys finished that report.
Yes, when we started the report, the Renewable Energy Fund grants were just started. The legislature initiated that in 2008, and so when we started the report, I think we'd only done two rounds of reviews, and some of those projects were just getting their grants approved. Now we have some of the first of those that have been constructed, and we've gone from,
the report had 19 projects.
Right, and operating. I think we added about six more this year, and there are some additional ones being developed that should be added on this coming summer.
So what happens with this report? Can you guys just update the PowerPoint so that people can get up-to-date information, or how does that work?
Well, one of the things that the report was very useful in doing is that we have put together some working groups to improve the data availability for analyzing these projects. One of the things that was a bit of an obstacle on the report is that we don't have any automated mechanism for tracking the performance of wind. So what we generally did in this report was focus on the available data and make the best assessment that we can. In this past year, there's a wind working group and there's a subcommittee on data development that has happened, and the report was a good way to start the dialogue with a lot of the players, both the utilities, the wind developers, the Alaska Energy Authority, and the university, to start identifying the information that we all need to better understand and evaluate them. So the report was basically kind of a jump start, and I think we will be in a better position relatively soon to have more data to be more definitive in our analysis.
And I guess I should say you're just a co-author here, right? That the UAF is involved in this too?
Yes, the project was done. Basically, we received funding from the Alaska Energy Authority and the Denali Commission. And ICER worked together with University of Alaska Fairbanks, the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, and the Wind Diesel Application Center, known as WIDAC. And Catherine Keith was the co-author from WIDAC, and Toby Shore was another fellow economist who worked with me at ICER, and the three of us worked together on this report.
Well, you're the economist of the club, but you've got another economist that work with you. And I guess, then, as I understand it, one of the reasons for the proliferation of wind power is that, first off, that any place along the coast, there's a lot of wind. And second off, that once the technology was they got some of the wrinkles out of the technology, economically, it's just basically a no-brainer. It pays off really fast to get some wind generation. It's going to, the cost of diesel is so high that it pays itself off in a very short time.
Well, that, I would say that that's both true. That's true when you place wind where there is a good wind resource, because wind is complicated in that it's not, the wind doesn't blow steadily. And so the fact that it fluctuates and sometimes it doesn't blow at all. And then also in Alaska, we also have the issue that sometimes when it blows, you can have too much of a good thing. It makes integrating the wind into the system complex. And I'm not an engineer, I'll be the first to admit that, but there are some engineering challenges. One of the things that we think that we did a relatively good job on the report, even though we didn't have all the data that we might have liked, was we looked at the circumstances in which wind has been developed to date, and we found that having a good wind regime is really pretty critical, because the biggest obstacle in all of our energy in rural Alaska is that we have small populations and small loads, but yet, you know, energy is really critical, especially in the middle of winter, to be reliable. So there's a sweet spot where you can balance the cost of developing the wind system and how much energy you need from that. And so you have to have a pretty high capacity factor, which means the amount of time that you are producing wind based on your, you know, and it appears that around 30% in most of our isolated rural grids is, if you can't get above that amount, that you have to have wind that steadily, you're going to face some problems.
Yeah. And obviously, capital-wise, it's going to be more expensive here. For one thing, you're often going to need a crane.
Right.
You don't exactly have a crane just, you know, sitting up the creek most of the time.
Right, that's true. But most of the people who have been doing the construction of these projects, and we do have some really good construction outfits in Alaska, they, you know, what they've told me is the crane availability is sometimes overplayed, because we need cranes for a lot of things that we do in rural Alaska. That's not an, you know, that's...
And especially with the it being coastal as well, I would think that, you know, it's not as difficult as it might be some of the upriver places.
Right, right. But the real issue is that we have permafrost. The places that have permafrost, the engineering for the foundation is, that's challenging. And I'd say permafrost locations, and especially now that we're facing the situation where we have not as consistent a permafrost as we did 20 years ago with climate change, it means that our engineers designing and our people installing the foundations, it's a whole nother order of magnitude more complex than if you are actually installing one, let's say, along the Aleutian islands, where you have bedrock and you have better soils and you don't have permafrost. That's a completely different situation. So one of the things that we tried to do in this report was analyze the costs and maybe try to develop what are the regional costs, what are the site-specific costs, so that we know maybe you have to have a better wind regime as your capital costs go up to make sure that you can make up for the additional costs of construction.
But then on the other end of it, we have I guess, a building expertise and a building economy of scale, maybe even a little bit of an economy of demand. First off, for instance, you take AVEC. When AVEC decided to go wind, all of a sudden there's a whole lot. They have a reproducibility. In other words, if they can get it to work in one, they can do it in a bunch of others because they're AVEC and they got a bunch of villages, and all they got to do is figure out how much wind and how it, whether it pencils out. And they've been doing that. And then the other thing I would think would be that over time, there would be an expertise build up. So, and apparently there is at least one engineering firm now that just, these are the go-to guys for permafrost foundations now for your windmill.
Right, right. We are developing a lot of in-state expertise, and I continue to, one of my thoughts on this is that, you know, while we'd never want to have another one, we did become the experts on oil spill with the Exxon Valdez oil spill. I think with our high rural energy costs that we have the potential in these isolated grids to become the experts on cold climate, isolated grid, renewable energy, and especially wind applications. And we are developing expertise. We've been able to, our market is growing at a rate that we've been able to grow our in-state expertise and not, there's enough to keep them busy and growing, but not so many that we end up paying all of our money to out-of-state people, and we don't maintain and retain our expertise.
Yeah. And so that's an exciting prospect.
It is. It's
another Alaska industry.
It is another Alaska industry. And what was helpful, and the writing of that report was also very good because it was we do a lot of work with the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. Within the university, we have a pretty good team going. And together we applied for a Department of Energy, what's called an EPSCoR grant, that is specifically looked at helping to develop in-state expertise. And ours project was on wind energy, and we received a grant from DOE. It was the first DOE EPSCoR grant that was ever been awarded to Alaska, and we're specifically looking at wind development, isolated grids, high penetration, and also the social and community capacity aspects that contribute to having wind be successful. So it's pretty exciting, and I think that we're growing our private sector and our university expertise, and I think we will continue to export and build an export industry.
Well, I've been to a couple of presentations now by the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, and they're just a hotbed. And they've got all kinds of stuff going on over there. It does tend to go however the funding goes, and the funding comes and goes, and the currents go this way and that way and so forth. But, over time, they certainly have acquired an overview of a whole lot of different energy things that are going on in Alaska. And it's fascinating when you actually start digging in, just the scale of it, how much is going on.
Right.
I mean, like here we see, a year-old report. You got 19 wind augmentation programs, and that's obsolete now. You got at least five more?
right. Well, Gwen Holdman, who's the director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, it's perfect that she's the director of Energy and Power because she's a dynamo and she's a go-getter, and we're really lucky to have her at the University of Alaska.
Well, our guest is Jenny Fay, and she is an economist with the Institute for Social and Economic Research at the University of Alaska Anchorage. And one thing I wanted to ask you, I know you're not the engineer in the crowd, but you can't keep doing energy economics so many years without starting to absorb some of this engineering lingo. And one of those things would be penetration. So maybe you just explain what penetration is.
Okay, penetration basically refers to, and it's a system that was established as the wind industry was developing that looks at how much wind, how much of your total amount of energy that your system is using is coming from wind. So you, generally speaking, low penetration is in the realm of about below 20%. I don't have these numbers in front of me, everyone, so if I'm a little bit off, you know, forgive me. Medium penetration means that you're getting maybe 25 to 50, maybe 60% of your energy from wind. And high penetration means that you're getting in excess of that. And sometimes with high penetration systems, you're even able to turn off your diesel generators. Generally, with high penetration systems, you have a lot, it's a lot more complicated. You generally have to have things like flywheels or battery backups and to basically help keep your system in you know, your voltage regulation and all of those things, because it's pretty significant to take something as inconsistent as wind and be getting that much of your power from it.
Right.
That's one of the other aspects of the DOE grant that we have, is looking at higher penetration applications in Alaska, because especially with these small systems, the more you can get out of your wind through increasing the penetration levels, the more economic it is, because you're displacing more diesel. In Alaska, the St. Paul is a high penetration system, and it's operated for quite a few years quite successfully. Most of course,
they're going to have tons of wind out there in the middle of the Bering Sea.
Yeah, but you can still have tons of wind but not be able to do anything with it. So, I mean, we have tons of tide and all kinds of other renewable energy resources that the technology hasn't developed yet to be able to fully tap them. I think that's coming. But right now, most of the wind facilities that are in place in Alaska, the newly constructed ones, are medium penetration. And most of them are operating, I think they're displacing about 30 to 35% of their diesel. And that's a relatively safe place to be, because it's not too complicated. You still have some integration that you're doing, but you're not, you don't have quite the complicated electronics and storage devices. But we're hoping to get more communities in Alaska to that next step.
Yeah, and this medium penetration could just be a matter of wiring the community up so that you have some place to use that load. I mean, you get the windmill spinning like crazy, and you need to put that energy someplace. And so they're actually like getting laundromats, they're heating buildings, they get boilers that'll use that load now, as I understand it.
Yes, and that's
fascinating.
Yeah, it is. And that's actually one of the things that is really beneficial for a lot of our rural communities, because it's their thermal load that is what's kind of breaking their budgets. And so to be able to heat your school by basically taking the power that's not needed to the electric load, move it to an electric boiler, and be able to keep your water system and your community facilities and your school warm is a real positive for those communities.
Well, we're talking with Ginny Fay. She's an economist at the Institute for Social and Economic Research at the University of Alaska Anchorage. And Ginny, I want to thank you for kind of giving us a walkthrough of the basics of wind energy and rural communities, and what happens when you have a smallish community. How can you get the wind integrated into your power, or can you? And the first thing, as she points out, is you've got to have wind. But she's also pointing to some backside benefits that basically at a certain point you start using that power from the windmill for heating applications, and that is going to displace a whole bunch of diesel fuel from heating applications. And another thing she pointed out is that we're building a whole lot of expertise in Alaska that is probably exportable, and so we're actually making ourselves an industry. We are emerging into leadership right here in the state of Alaska. And because of that, people who know how to do this tend to be in demand. When I started trying to book guests for this program, I discovered people are all having to do stuff. So, for instance, Kodiak, you know, it would be great to talk about the example of Kodiak, because this is, along with St. Paul, is one of the shining examples where they put up big windmills, and they are getting tremendous savings on it. And it's largely because you know, they don't have to have a laundromat or something to throw that load into. They've got hydro.
Right, right.
Yeah, but he's busy. He can't talk to us. But who we are able to get is Jay Hermanson, who is with the WH Pacific, right, Jay?
Yes, that is correct.
And why don't you tell me a little bit about what your outfit does?
Sure. We are a wholly owned subsidiary of NANA Regional Corporation, and we are the largest Native American-owned architecture and engineering company in the United States. We have offices from Barrow, Alaska, down to Albuquerque and everywhere in between. One of our specialties as it relates to this particular topic is actually working with rural communities on rural energy planning and wind diesel development, and have been working with communities along the North Slope, with the North Slope Borough, with the NANA region, and a couple of other communities down in the Yukon, Kuskokwim Delta. We have wind diesel projects from at very early stage of concept and feasibility, and all the way to final design and construction management in the case of Kotzebue Electric Association. So we work with a variety of clients, cooperatives. We work with resource development companies. We work with local government entities on planning for change, essentially, planning to change from the status quo, which is diesel power generation, to hopefully something that is not as reliant on the status quo.
Yeah, and apparently the NANA vision is to get, and I'm reading it right off the sheet here, 25% decrease of imported fossil fuels by 2015, which is only a few years off here, 50% decrease by 2020, 75% decrease by 2030. And so it looks like you've got your work cut out for you.
We have our work cut out for us. So in within the NANA region, that's a being that NANA Regional Corporation is our parent company, that is one of our special clients. And we have, dating back to 2007, we have been working with NANA Regional Corporation and the stakeholders in the region on regional planning of energy projects. And we aimed high. We aimed high as having an aggressive objective to get there. We hope through a diversified approach, including wind diesel, but also looking at energy efficiency, looking at diesel efficiencies, looking at even at small-scale hydroelectric development, we hope to achieve those particular objectives.
Wow. So you're basically a construction firm then?
We are an engineering company.
Oh, I see. So it is, yeah. And so you're probably somewhat acquainted with these engineering challenges. You know, I remember long ago, because Brad Reeve was a public radio manager in Kotzebue, and he went over to the power co-op there, and he really was the pioneer. Kotzebue Electric was the pioneer of getting wind power going. And then it turns out, when you actually take a look at the wind, Kotzebue was not the best place to do this. And that's not the only problem that they ran into. They had just an absolute cascade of problems, but have been prevailing through all of it. And now this falls into your hands. You basically start right out with a position of leadership, I guess I would say.
Yeah, Brad has been very much a leader on rural power issues for many, many years, and many of us look to Brad for leadership and wisdom and guidance, and he's continuing to be a pioneer on the wind diesel side. He's, you know, the plan is for Kotzebue Electric Association is to install larger wind turbines than what was installed back in the late 90s. The objective is to install 900 kW EWT turbines in Kotzebue itself, and a much larger turbine that can allow for a greater deal of penetration in the environment.
How does that compare with the Kodiak? What's
I believe Kodiak has two 1.5 megawatt GEs.
Okay.
In Kodiak, but I honestly have not visited Kodiak, and I don't know a lot about the project. But the challenges of doing this in the Arctic versus, you know, good soils of Kodiak, you know, should not be underestimated. the site at the wind farm site in Cotsby right now is discontinuous permafrost, and you have some pretty significant loading associated with these larger turbines, which the engineering team is working through right now. So where KEA is going with this is, you know, it's going to be a model project once again, and something that we should all look to as a model in the future.
Wow. We're talking to Jay Herbertson of WH Pacific. It's a NANA subsidiary, and they've taken on the mission of trying to defer a whole lot of diesel costs for the entire NANA area, among their many, many other engineering challenges and jobs that they have all across the United States. It's a pleasure having you with us. You want to stick with us, Jay, here?
Sure.
Okay. Jenny, maybe you have a question or two for him. I know you were very curious about what the plans were up there.
So when do you think there will be, what's their goal for installing these larger turbines, Jay?
The construction plan is for within the next year, is what the plan is. So it's a pretty aggressive schedule.
And what are they going to do? Are they going to replace the turbines that they have in place now, or
no,
are there going to be an addition?
What's already there? So the issue with Kotzebue is that it does actually have a good wind resource. It has about a class 3 wind resource, but Kotzebue is a much bigger load than most of the other rural communities around Alaska, and it's a different animal, if you will. It's a different entity. And when the turbines, when the AOCs were initially installed back in the late 90s, that was pretty much all that was available in the marketplace at that time. So there really weren't any other choices available when they were making those decisions on the wind farm back at that time. So now the marketplace has advanced. There are more choices available. There are more options to consider, which back in the late 90s just simply were not there.
Yeah, I know Brad is pretty much familiar with those old turbines on a monkey wrench level. Yeah. Thank you, Jay. I got this email from Mike Lyle, who says, I just returned from Kodiak last week, reffing some basketball games, saw the windmills on top of the mountain overlooking the bay. Not only are they a sight to see, but from what the locals are saying, it's been a blessing as well. 40% drop in energy rates plus untold barrels of fuel saved. And yeah, that is documented. I heard there are 2 more windmills going up. It is a start. Hope other communities come aboard and adopt this type of energy. That from Mike in Anchorage. Our email is talk@APRN.org, and our phone number is 1-800-478-8255. Let's go to Bob now, who joins the program from Nome. Bob, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a good, hope your day is going good.
Oh, so far so good. It's just fascinating learning all this. It's been kind of a steep learning curve for me, but, I enjoy doing a show about stuff I don't know much about.
Yeah, well, I understand the steep learning curve. A little overview is I work for a company called Western Community Energy. We manage the Banner Wind Farm on behalf of Banner Wind LLC out here, which is 50% owned by Sitnisok Native Corporation, 50% by Bering Strait.
Okay, so there you are in Nome with plenty of wind.
Plenty of wind. And I also have a newer version of the AOC wind turbine that Brad Reeve has up in Kotzebue there. So as Jay said, I am also very versed in the monkey wrench side of the AOC turbine, which we've been able to take care of a lot of the fixes for it, and we're still working on them, but doing pretty good. I would like to speak a little bit about a few of the points that your other guests have spoke about. One is the social aspect of wind. Myself as a single dad, I struggle sometimes on a single income with the paying the bills in a rural community out here where energy is rather high and the utilities is doing their best all the time, but it still costs a little bit. And you look at the aspect of people being afforded to live where they choose to live or where they need to be in support of their family. Again, my kids now go back and forth between mom and I. And And if one of us, we've agreed that neither of us will leave for a better job or anything until the kids are old enough, because of they need their mom and their dad in the same city. They need equal time. And if people can't afford their utility bill and they have to leave for the bigger, better job in Anchorage, the social aspect there is just tremendous that I think a lot of people might miss with the long distance. I know nowadays in this the society that we have, it's a little more acceptable to live that way by some people's beliefs. But I feel that it's one of the bigger impacts on society today, this aspect of broken families and having to move away, and especially when you're talking about because of pay.
Yeah, and you know, I think you this is I have never seen a study that quantifies this, but when you have households in which both partners have to work in order to make enough money to support their family, you clearly are getting in a situation where people are getting stuck in a coop.
Oh yes, definitely. I know I've been in that pickle myself, and that's very frustrating.
So if we can spin it,
Chamber of Commerce.
All right, yeah, Bob, if we can get it back around to, I think you wanted to get on to the cost of power. Is that where you're going with this?
Oh yeah,
yeah, because we heard from Mike
that's what's costing us. Well, we're speaking to several different things, and then that is one of the main things is getting enough penetration to displace enough fuel to where, you know, you can provide a cheaper power. Utilities is charged by their charter to provide good, clean energy and reliable energy to the people. And this wind and lots of other renewables do add some complexities to the system. And how do they maintain enough in their funds in their general funds to maintain the grid? One thing that I've seen out here a little bit with some of these wind turbines going in is getting them to run with the older facilities. You know, the older generators just don't ramp up and handle the swings. So again, we need the battery technology, the storage. A lot of the technology is out there. It's just, can you afford it? Who's going to pay for it? And can you tie it in with all the systems?
Yeah, Bob, I think that this is being seen all over the state, as I understand, and there is some progress. Ginny Fay?
I had a question kind of for both Bob and Jay. One of the things that...
Wait a minute. I'll tell you what. We better take our break right now or we're going to get illegal. So we'll go ahead and do the break and come back with Ginny Fay's question. Stay on the line there, Bob and Jay, and we'll be back as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by... Pennair, operating since 1955 and providing 9 destinations with service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations and rates online at pennair.com. Are home heating costs more than you can manage? If you're living on a fixed income or reduced income, the Heating Assistance Program may be able to help. To obtain more information or an application form, visit the Heating Assistance Program website at heatinghelp.alaska.gov or call 1-800-470-3058. Sometimes a little help makes all the difference. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
We're talking about wind power on Talk of Alaska. It used to be the wind power is how we shipped things. Now, wind power is basically harvesting a little bit of the energy of the wind and using it to help turn your electric power plant to where you don't have to burn so much diesel. You would think that was simple. It's not simple. If you have a very small community, you've got to consider the load. When does the load happen and how are you going to be prepared for that load? And then you've got to consider how do you mesh in a cycle that's based on the wind compared to a cycle that's based on when people need power and how. So it's complicated, as they say, but slowly they're ironing their way through these problems. And we have Ginny Fay, an economist at the University of Alaska Anchorage Institute of Social and Economic Research. And we have Jay Hermanson, who is with an engineering firm, WH Pacific, which has part of its job to try and defer fuel costs up in the NANA region. It's a subsidiary of NANA. And then we have Bob, who's a technician with working on the wind turbines in Nome. And Jenny had a question for both of them.
Well, my question was, I think that Nome, Banner Wind and the Nome area Native Corporations did a very nice partnership that was able to take advantage of the federal production tax credits on wind. And as a result, despite the fact that there were some issues and a lot of hard work that the Banner Wind folks had to do, the community, Western community group had to, developers had to do to get the turbines to work, they still come out with utility rates, electric rates, as a result of those tax credits that make the Nome credit, the Nome electric rates are pretty good. So my question for Jay was whether or not your work in the Northwest Arctic Borough with NANA was whether or not that business model was also looking at taking advantage of those tax credits, which my perception from our first round of analyses is maybe we haven't done as good a job as we could have to lower the cost via those tax credits.
You bring up a really good point. I don't, you know, overall in Alaska, I don't really think that any entities are really utilizing the investment tax credit or the production tax credit to its greatest benefit. You know, when you look at communities like Nome or Kotzebue or Bethel or Barrow, you know, essentially the hub communities of Alaska, those are the economies there are relatively sophisticated compared to some of the smaller communities in other parts of Alaska. Once you scale a project down from a larger community such as Nome or Kotzebue down to a community of 100, 200, 300 people, the option of I'll put it in quotations, an investment for a return on investment for financial purposes makes it much more difficult to pencil out. A lot of times the cooperatives working at the village level, it's more of providing a social service instead of an actual investment opportunity. So that's, I think, one of the challenges that we have in Alaska is how can we create an attractive investment client environment for investment in these smaller in the smaller communities where we can actually approach a developer or an investor or an Alaskan who wants to put some money into the future of Alaska and have some assurances that there is going to be a return on their investment. I think it's really difficult to have multiple power producers in a small community, other than like a Kotzebue or a Nome, and we need to come up with policies that can promote that third party investment, that for profit investment, so we can take advantage of the ITC and the production tax credit.
Okay, so Banner, I guess to cut to the chase, Banner was able to do it, but you don't see how you can WH Pacific.
Nome is a big community, and I think that the economics are there in a larger community. When you scale it down from a community of 3,000-4,000 people down to a community of 3,400 people or less, the economics aren't necessarily there to make it a true investment.
I got it. Yeah. Okay. Jay. Thank you. I want to see if we've got Bob. I sensed Bob and Nome.
Yeah.
The turbine technician.
Yes, I'm still here.
You had a little something more you wanted to bring in, I think.
Banner Wind, again, was funded by two local Native corporations. And as was stated earlier, that when Brad up in Kotzebue, Brad Reeve installed his AOCs, the 50 kW generators, that's pretty much what was available. The decision by Banner Wind to use that same turbine was to provide a maintenance base here in Nome. There's 18 of these turbines, which has the potential to provide about 25% of Nome's power. And they went with several smaller turbines so that this could be a support base so that they could put them in all their villages and their member villages so that they could help reduce the cost of energy. When you think of investment, don't think of investment firms into this wind as an investment firm out of New York. All our local big Native corporations here have a tax liability. that's the person that you need to go after for the funding. And I'm sure most of these, you know, as Bering Straits Native Corporation would invest, get their tax credits out of their villages. That's kind of what this whole point was of Banner Wind. Unfortunately, you cannot make a person that owns that power plant buy power from you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So this is happening all over the place now. Yeah.
If they don't want to accept the private investment, they don't have to.
Right. Yeah.
It's not quite as complex as you would think. I don't believe in my experiences to get a native corporation to invest into their communities. That's kind of what Banner Wind was.
Okay. Hey, Bob, I want to thank you for your call from Nome. I want to clear out for more calls.
Mm-hmm. No problem.
All right. Thanks a lot. And Doug chipped in and said, all this development of wind energy is great. My question, what's being done to train local people to maintain local wind turbines? Once they're up, are we erecting machines only to need to import workers to keep them running? Decreasingly, wouldn't you say, Ginny Fay? We're beginning to get somewhere on that.
Well, the AVTEC in Seward has just developed a wind training program. I think their first class is coming up in March. That's also one of the principal issues that the WIDAC, the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, the Wind Application Center, which is a partnership between the university, the national laboratories, and the Denali Commission, I think they also do some funding, and the Alaska Energy Authority. And one of those specific issues is looking at training, because that's a critical piece. And I think there's a lot of work being done on that. And it's not, while I'm not part of that, it's one of the things that we brought up was being critical in the report, and there are definitely people working on it. And there are a lot of people who want to be trained and are interested in these jobs. And the real issue is also scalability. I think we'll probably end up with kind of a regional, I envision something like a regional cooperative where you have different people who have different skills. Maybe Nome becomes the traveling people for the AOC, and then someone who's been gone through training with AVEC, and you have a few of those. Wind technicians become the experts on the Northwind 100s, and then someone out of Kodiak becomes, you know, the larger turbine wind experts, and that we basically share that expertise.
Yeah. So we heard then from Nome that they deliberately chose the technology was being used in nearby Kotzebue in hopes of getting local hire. And I guess Jay Hermanson, that would be an issue for you as well at WH Pacific, is trying to have as much local hire as possible.
Well, that's an objective of that needs to be addressed. When you're at the village level and working with the various stakeholders in a community, wind could be viewed as a threat too. It could be a threat to a job. So what you got to do at the village level is to show how this can add value for the community. On a follow-on point is that, you know, the AVEC in particular and the other cooperatives do have diesel power plant operators who have been operating power plants for years, for 40, 50 years in rural Alaska. And these are very, very savvy people who can learn the new technologies fairly quickly.
Yeah.
And AVEC in particular has done a wonderful job of training their power plant operators to take care of the basic maintenance and operations aspects of the wind turbines that they currently have deployed in Alaska.
And I think also they have sent some of their operators, their diesel operators, to the wind training program that are offered by the manufacturers, and they also have a lot of the manufacturers provide 3 to 5 year maintenance warranties that include training of operators, is my understanding.
I got an email here from Dan, who says, I worked in Nelson Lagoon in the summer of 77 to 78, and at that time they had an experimental two-blade turbine built by Grumman. The blades were 25 or 50 foot each. I believe the effort was sponsored by the state. There were Grumman technicians there much of the summer, and the turbine was getting repaired much more than it ran. That was not unusual around that time. When it did run, it was pretty impressive with those long blades, but I never hear mention of this, and just wondering if anybody else knows about this or if it's on the record someplace. Did you ever hear of that one, Ginny Faye?
Not that one in particular, but I think the sort of the alternative energy that happened in the late 70s and early 80s, is my understanding, is that that's a pretty good model for how you don't want to do things. In that,
I can't tell you how many of my friends are just crushed that you would say that.
And that would be true on a national level. That wasn't just Alaska, because they basically, a little bit like buying a racehorse for a tax write-off, and it might not win the race, but you did okay with your taxes, and so I think that legacy is actually something that is unfortunate, but I don't think we're doing it that way. We're making very conscious efforts to not have it be done that way. Jay, maybe you have some more to add to that.
Just that many of us working in the industry have heard many stories about what happened in the 70s and 80s about the investments in various types of rural energy initiatives, and those working in the industry do not want to see that happen again. We want to provide long-term solutions. Going back to the examples that we've been talking about, whether it's the Banner Wind Farm in Nome, the KEA example in Kotzebue, some of AVEC's work with Tuxik Bay and other areas in Kodiak Electric Association. I mean, I think the technology is proving itself in a very conservative manner, but proving itself nonetheless.
Okay, we're going to go to Delta when Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from The Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. When you file online for your PFD, you can donate to any of the 91 organizations that help Alaskans pull their lives back together after an emergency. Get more with your PFD when you pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation and the Mat-Su Health Foundation.
Here we are again talking about energy. It's Talk of Alaska, and this time we're talking about wind power, and Mike joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Mike.
Hello there.
Hi, how you doing?
If I was any better, I'd have to lie about it. we have a 900 kilowatt turbine, as you guys might know, that's been up and operational, and year to date we're just over 1 million kilowatt hours of power into the northern end of the rail belt grid. And that includes a little bit of power that we got out of our Northern 100 as well. And I wanted to congratulate Kotzebue on making an excellent choice on those 900 kilowatt turbines. I think you guys are going to be totally impressed with them. We've had some days where we were over 20,000 kilowatt hours on a single turbine in one day. That's an average of about 850 some kW on a 900 kW turbine. And we've had really good success with the 900. I congratulate you guys on your choices. And I would like to touch on one thing that's been discussed here, and that is the private sector. When you guys were talking about how do you get private capital into the equation, and you touched on it when you talked about access to these utilities, whether they're rural community utilities or whether they're one of the six major utilities on the rail belt grid. Access has been the reason why this hasn't moved forward. If we have to wait on the government to solve some of these problems for us, we're going to be waiting a lot longer, and we're going to spend a lot more money doing it.
Hey, Mike, let me ask you this, though. If we have to wait for RCIA to figure it out, might we have to wait even longer?
Well, you know, the RCA, I think, is actually not the enemy that people might think that it is. I think the RCA has a reputation for being a little bit adversarial with the utilities, but I think that's just a natural relationship between the utilities and the RCA. Obviously, the utilities are are asking for more and more, and the RCA is trying to protect the public. So I think that's that adversarial relationship that currently exists is kind of a natural thing, you know.
But I don't know a single utility that's serious about buying power from anybody, even another utility.
That comes from the fact that the state of Alaska has opted out of the FERC requirements, and the Federal Regulatory Commission that's making all of the utilities in the lower 48 buy into these renewable energy systems. They don't have any real teeth up here because we don't we basically don't sell electricity across state lines, our state lines. So that killed the interstate commerce portion of the Federal Regulatory Commission's.
Well, doesn't that then put it up to RCA?
No, actually, it doesn't.
Well, so what do you need? We need a better statutory framework or whatnot? I mean, I think we need to start getting this done. You know, this business with the Fire Island wind farm and the Susitna Dam is just, it's kind of hilarious if you don't live in the middle of it.
Well, you know, it's pretty easy for people that are in government to say, you know, I support renewable energy, and they might give you a little lip service, and then they go on and have lunch. the bottom line is my trips to Juneau about this issue have gotten me nowhere. And the bottom line is, unless the legislators and the governor are willing to put some teeth into renewable energy dispatch, then it's going to be very difficult for us to move along. I'm in the midst of negotiating a power sales agreement. We've got a $50 million wind farm project ready to roll. We've already lost our second year because we haven't been able to negotiate a power sales agreement with Golden Valley Electric Association. And so bottom line is there's 200 jobs that people could have had this summer. We could displace 13,900 gallons of diesel every day of the week, every of the year, if they would just let us move forward. And that's at the current avoided cost. That's not even a premium. That is cheaper power and cleaner power, and we're still fighting to get that done. And that comes from the fact that the utilities don't have to buy this power. So to get and I think the native corporations are the perfect private capital sources for some of these projects in rural Alaska for sure. I mean, look at Surrey. I mean, there's a prime example. They're a native corporation. They've been trying to do something on the rail belt grid. They run into opposition almost completely. And some of the stuff that the utilities come up with to try and kind of protect their position, be totally frank, is a bunch of BS.
Yeah.
There was a
Well, all right. I think we're getting a little one-sided on this one, and it's probably difficult. And I did want to try and stay on the rural non-grid energy issue in this show, but I think this is it's not that I'm shying away from this. It's just that I really want to explore it, and you know, I've certainly heard.
If my craft hadn't put up a 900 kilowatt turbine in Delta Junction on the rail belt grid, Kotzebue wouldn't be ordering two of them right now. Hmm. So they are connected.
All right.
You know, they are connected.
Mike, I really want to thank you for your call.
Thank you.
All right. It is Talk of Alaska. We're talking wind power, and clearly, there's a lot to it. You know, Ginny, I know you don't want to step into this minefield of the electric grid and the utilities buying or not buying. So I'm not going to ask you to, and I'm going to go to line six, where Shelley joins the program from Fairbanks. You have been so patient, Shelley. Are you there, Shelley in Fairbanks? Oh, well, she's so patient, she found something else to do. All right, let's go to Guy in Valdez. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Guy.
Well,
did we cover your issue yet?
No, you didn't, and I'm glad you have an engineer on. And I wanted to talk to Jay about...
She's an economist. She's an economist, and Jay is an engineer. Well, I don't know. Right. Are you an engineer, Jay?
I'm actually not. I'm a planner. A planner.
Well, that's what I want. All of our little rural electric companies that we have around here, you know, we're still burning a lot of diesel, Jay. And what I was trying to get our co-op here to do in Valdez was to think about hydrogen, because then they can produce their own fuel. You know, I heard that to produce hydrogen, you need electricity and water, and we have plenty of water down here, and we have an electric company. They could make their own fuel, burn hydrogen to make the electricity instead of diesel, which the prices vary. And if they produce their own hydrogen. They don't have to have the fuel transported anywhere. It's right here. And we could have these rural electric companies producing not only our electricity, but they could produce fuel to run our vehicles, because all we'd have to do is take our vehicles and take the tanks out of them and put, like, the propane tanks that they put in, and we could run our vehicles.
Yeah, Guy, you're not the first person that's brought that up. I will tell you, you know, just very briefly, because we only got a few minutes left, but basically they found that, let me tell you, this is an engineering challenge, fundamentally. Somebody has to demonstrate it. The catalyst has been found. There are people trying to engineer this. It hasn't happened yet, and it probably isn't going to happen first in Valdez. Guy, I want to thank you so much for your call. It's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about the power of wind. And it turns out it is really powerful. We've got Jenny Fay of ICER and Jay Hermanson with WH Pacific, which has got the mandate of engineering the way to eliminating a bunch of fuel costs in the Nana region. Well, we're just about at wind-up time, and I'm wondering, Jenny, if this tops out at a certain point. In other words, how much of the potential that Alaska has to defray fuel cost have we already done, and how much more could we do?
I'm
sure that's a bigger question than an economist could really feel comfortable answering.
Well, but I guess I would say right now that I think that we're only at the beginning of this, because I think it hasn't been that much time since we've just introduced the first ones of these. The technology is improving significantly. And I think what's going to happen is that we will get some systems in place in many of the communities that have good wind resources. And then I think what's going to happen is once we have those in place and they're medium penetration systems and just a small number of high penetration, I think we will become more skilled operators. The technology will improve, and we will be upping the penetration and displacing more and more diesel. I think also as the technology gets better, I think there are likely to be opportunities where lower penetration systems can work because fuel prices continue to go up. And I personally think that we're just at the beginning, and I'm not sure we completely understand what all the opportunities are here.
Jay Hermanson, does the Renewable Energy Fund play into your plans at all?
Oh, absolutely. It's, you know, the state of Alaska has one of the most generous programs to support rural power development in the country, for that matter, and it's been very much a catalyst to jumpstart ideas. And Alaskans are full of plenty of great ideas, and sometimes it just needs a little capital, a little push to move that idea and make it a reality. And in the HB 152, the State of Alaska Renewable Energy Fund has been a great catalyst to move concepts along.
All right, we're out of time, and I want to thank you so much for joining us, both Jenny Fay, Jay Hermanson, and thanks to our phone people, Josh and Jersey, and Dave. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. One answer to our state's declining oil production? Fort McKenzie Rail Project. The link from the Alaska Railroad to a deepwater port will bring billions in mineral production and thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.